This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given. We had a plan for today's show, a series of stories all set in the water, meant to bring some joy to an otherwise difficult summer. But then something happened in the water that isn't joyful at all. Here's G.
My full proper name is Gannett Wright-Muir, and I go by G.
G is a former competitive swimmer. So is her 23-year-old son. Under normal circumstances, G and her son swim with a group called Diversity in Aquatics. It's an organization dedicated to making sure that everyone has the opportunity to learn to swim. But it's also a master's swim club where swimmers like G get together in Fort Lauderdale for organized workouts. But G and her son hadn't swam with their club in a while.
We hadn't swam together since March because of the pandemic. So going to the pool that day, we were really excited. My son, he hadn't exercised throughout the pandemic, really. So he did the research to figure out, are there any pools in Fort Lauderdale that allow for lap swimming? He found two pools within 10 minutes of us. We were not familiar with either one. And we picked that pool, the Carter Park pool, because of the schedule. We were going to swim on the Sunday. As we entered the pool, the person at the entrance, young white man, said, "Hey, this is for lap swimming." We were like, "Yeah," but I understood he meant as opposed to recreational swim. But for me, that's like already like a microaggression and like an implicit bias that I feel he has, that seeing two black people, he's feeling, "Hey, you might be at the wrong place because this is for people who can actually swim laps." So, you know, it just was a moment. I kept walking, but I noticed it, you know.
I'm going to stop you for just a second because there's something about this pool that has come up, and it sounds like you didn't know this about the pool, but the pool was built during segregation specifically as a place for black families to swim. Was that in your knowledge base at all at the time?
So what I knew was that I knew I was going into a black neighborhood, but I didn't know that that pool was built during segregation. I learned it later on that day when people were shocked and everything.
Okay, so you get to the pool.
So because we know it's in a black neighborhood, I'm also expecting black people. But as I walked in, my eyes scanned and I saw every single person was white. So that struck me as well. So we asked if we could swim in the same lane. The young man at the entrance said, yes. When we went towards the pool, the lifeguard said no. And we were like, it's fine. And then she's put us close to each other, but there's a woman between us. Fine. My son went straight into the pool. It's icy cold. He went in and started swimming. I'm kind of taking my time. I'm sitting on the ledge. I have my legs in. He does maybe three or four, maybe I guess four or five, six laps. He does several enough laps. And I say to him something like, I honestly don't remember, but it's something like, what stroke are you doing next? Something just simple like that. One quick sentence. He replied very quickly. And then the woman pretty much says in a very harsh tone, she didn't greet us. She said, you can't talk over my lane. And I just felt suddenly like, barked at. It was just really brash. And then she kept swimming. So I just asked the lifeguard if that was a rule, because with COVID, you don't know. I just want to know if that's the rule. And the lifeguard said, that's not a rule. I swim a little bit. And when I encounter the woman again, I say, hey, you know, it's not a rule. If you'd like to, you could switch lanes. Me and my son will be side by side because we're not going to talk like have a conversation, but we're going to say things. Right. I'm going to ask him how many laps. He's better at keeping track of what we're doing. And we were going to swim a mile, which is several laps in a 25-meter pool.
That's a long ways.
That's a long way.
And I want to say, like, from doing a lot of lap swimming myself, switching lanes is something people do all the time. It's really easy.
Thank you. Yes, exactly. So she said, in the same brash tone, I'm not moving. It was just so odd for me because the way she was speaking to me was just so harsh, you know. And I just felt like this felt so unreasonable. So I said to her something like, hey, well, you know, me and my son are going to speak. Soon after that, she's complaining, the lifeguard needs to do something about us, do something about us. She's not just telling her to do something about us. She's also threatening her job. Like she knows her boss and supervisor. So, and I'm so disappointed, you know, and I felt it for my son. Like he would look up puzzled, like what's happening? Like there's still something happening, you know? So at some point she says to the lifeguard, you need to call the police, call the police. I'm distraught now because, you know, with the history of black people and the police and the current climate. And I actually say to them, I'm saying, why are you calling the police? I actually said, do you watch the news? Have you read any articles recently? I'm here with my son, and my son is a young black man, right? He's in his young 20s. And we're instantly vulnerable. the young man at the entrance rushes up to say, close the pool, everybody out. The swimmer in the water, the woman who harassed us, she says she's not coming out. And my son says, neither am I. And I'm actually proud of him. You know, I'm proud of him. My son is, people who know him are like, wow, because he's an introverted young man. Then we heard the police were coming. And I said, Masai, you know, I told my son, you have to come out. And it was hard for me because I knew she could stay in the pool and I knew he could not. And that was very hard for me.
So, wow. So as you're waiting for the police to arrive, what's your emotion like at that moment?
I'm distraught. By that point, I am distraught. I am. My girlfriend was planning to join us. So I called her and said, don't come to the pool. She said, I'm pretty much here. So she comes. When she heard the police were coming, she asked, should we leave? You know, instead of the police encounter. So my mind is like, should I leave? I'm here with my son. We're Black people. Is something going to happen? Are we going to become hashtags? This is just like seconds. And then I felt like, why should I have to like scurry away? So I said, no. So when the police walked onto the deck, it was a surreal feeling. You're standing in a swimsuit, you know, my son is in his trunks. It's very vulnerable, you know, and that lady is in the pool. She didn't have to get out. And then the police commanded her out and she said, no. So when they asked us to leave the deck, my son once again was like, we need to see her out of this pool. You know, we know she's the one who's antagonizing us and she gets to stay. You know, we're going back and forth. But while you're arguing with people who have guns on their hips and you're thinking this is certainly not worth our safety at this point. So I said, we have to leave. We have to walk by her standing in the pool. For my son to see that, it was really hard for me because I feel like everything that we've done with raising our kids in America, we have taught them that being Black is not going to give you a disadvantage. You should not be feeling that you're inferior. So we go into the parking lot and my son says, you know, let's wait here. Let's make sure she does get out. And then the officers, at least two, if not all three, come out to the parking lot and they said, we have to leave the whole parking lot. And my son says, I need to see her leave. And it's really just to know he's being treated equally, you know, like not being discriminated against. And the officer said, you have to leave the entire compound, the entire park, and you can't return for 24 hours. Meanwhile, that lady's in the pool. So, I mean, so that was really, I mean, we left there. I mean, I was sickened. And for my son, I mean, we got home and he said, you know, mommy, I was trying to protect you. And I just broke down because I was like, I was trying to protect you. And none of us had the power. None of us had power.
Well, the Fort Lauderdale police told Newsweek that everybody was treated the same, but body cam footage shows the woman told the officers that she was, quote, in a state of undress, and she refused to get out of the water until you and your son had left. What do you make of the fact that she was allowed to make that demand?
Well, it to me it's racist. They treated us equally in terms of demanding the same thing, demanded us all out the pool. We are not equal that they didn't require her to get out of the pool. We're all in a state of undress, so she was not dressed any differently than any of us. So we're all in the same boat and should have been treated that way.
You know, we talk about privilege, but it's privilege to be able to say no to the police.
Yeah, no, that's a privilege that we don't have. If we're in the pool, the story would be mother and son shot up in a pool. And then some people would be extremely upset that we're shot up, and some people would say, well, they were ordered, they refused, what could they do? She did not even get shouted at. In 2020, it might as well have been 1960.
How has this continued to affect you and your son?
You know, it's been a lot. It's been traumatic. It has been helpful that we've had overwhelming support from the community. So that's very validating for us, but especially my son. This is the community saying to him, you are correct. You were right. You were being treated differently. So that's really helpful to be validated. I don't know if you're aware that there was a swim-in on Sunday.
I am. I was about to ask you about that.
Okay, yeah.
So you are part of this group called Diversity in Aquatics, and one of the things that they're really focused on is addressing the barriers that have historically excluded Black people from pools and learning how to swim. And so tell me, what actually happens at a swim-in? Do you actually swim?
We actually did swim. So what we had was we had speakers. I spoke. It was really hard. Like, my voice cracked the entire time. But it was restorative for us to get back in the water a week later. I mean, my stomach was in a knot just approaching that property. I had never been there before. My own experience was a nightmare. So to go back was challenging. But to go back in, you know, being embraced by the community, some people said, hey, what happened to you happened to us. We all felt it. When they heard the story, they're like, this is not just you. This is an assault on all of us. I think one of the good things from this is that we're learning more about that. This is not just an isolated incident. And this is part of a history of Black people feeling unwelcome around the water. And that's why this organization is so helpful.
Absolutely. So I have not mentioned until now that you are a lawyer. And the reason I haven't brought that up is that there are some people who are making the very good point that a person shouldn't have to be a highly educated professional to be believed right. And listened to in this kind of situation. What do you make of the attention your experience has gotten?
Well, it's interesting because there's no doubt that because I'm engaged in my community, it did get more attention. When I lived in New York City, I was about 19 years old, and I lived in a Jewish neighborhood that was an affluent neighborhood. And one night, I was coming from work. I worked at Madison Square Garden on Mark Police car. People came out and they jumped me. They asked me what I was doing in the neighborhood. I said, my mom, she owns an apartment in this neighborhood. I was devastated. I just broke down crying. And I was 19, 20 years old. And the next morning, I went to the police station and complained, and nothing. Now, several years later, you know, I was able to speak to the mayor the next morning, and someone higher up in the police department called me. But it shouldn't matter.
What has it been like for you to have to tell this story over and over again? Because I imagine that there's a part of you that just wants to move on.
Yes, it's a traumatic experience for me. I experienced it with my son, my first child. You know, we didn't need the police here. Like, we didn't need three men with guns on the pool deck. Like, this could have been resolved. When you're calling police on Black people because of the history of Black people and the police, it's deadly, potentially deadly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so grateful, of course, me and my son were not physically harmed, but we could have been.
G. Wright Muir is a lawyer and LGBTQ advocate. We'll link to more information about Diversity in Aquatics on our website, onlyagame.org. How did the second deadliest day in New York City history help lead to modern swimwear for women? The answer's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
Doesn't love a good story? On Circle Round, the storytelling podcast from WBUR, we adapt folk tales from around the world as radio plays, featuring beloved stars of the stage and screen, like Seinfeld's Jason Alexander, Hamilton star Philippa Sue, and Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award winner Billy Porter. Circle Round has been named a top kids podcast by The New York Times, Good Housekeeping, and Time Magazine, and we think you'll love it too. Find Circle Round wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Karen Given. The 2020 Tokyo Summer Games were supposed to be happening right now.
It's all the USA now with 3/4 of a body length. Thames and
back in Rio in 2016, Team USA won gold medals in 8 women's swimming events. The rest of the world combined for 10. But for most of American history, swimming was not an accepted activity for women. That started to change in the early 20th century because of a creative Australian and the second deadliest day in New York City history. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
On a Wednesday morning in June 1904, a sidewheel passenger steamboat called the General Slocum left Manhattan.
It had been chartered by St. Mark's Evangelical Church on the Lower East Side to take a group out for a picnic on Long Island.
That's Haley Shapley, journalist and author of the recent book Strong Like Her.
There was a band playing on the ship welcoming passengers aboard, And it was mostly women and children who were going on this voyage, celebrating the beginning of summer. And it was a short journey, but the sailing was part of the fun.
Okay, so what happens early in the voyage?
Within a half an hour, probably even sooner, of them pulling away, a fire broke out in the forward part of the ship. It's never been exactly established why this fire broke out, but once it did, it took over everything. There were a lot of reasons for that. The captain chose to go into the winds, which fanned the flames. The paint aboard was flammable. The crew had never practiced a fire drill, and the fire just very quickly consumed the forward part of the ship, and it was under an hour that it was totally wrecked.
The life jackets on board were faulty, and the lifeboats were inaccessible. The next day, the New York Times reported,
"With sure death from fire behind, the women waited until the flames were upon them, until they felt their flesh blister, before they took the alternative of the river."
The burning boat was still heading up the East River, not very far from land.
It could have been a potentially swimmable distance. If most of the people aboard knew how to swim and hadn't been constrained by the clothing of the era, there would have been more of an opportunity for survivors.
But back then, in the early 1900s, Shapley says swimming was considered a masculine domain in the U.S., and few women had learned how to do it.
And one of the main reasons for that was modesty and the outfits that were necessary for swimming. Bathing costumes for women included about 7 to 10 yards of fabric, and they were usually made of wool or flannel, which were fabrics chosen because they could keep swimmers warm, but they weren't chosen for their buoyancy. Mm. So with wool tights, with knee-length bloomers, a sailor-style blouse, a belt, a full skirt, and then shoes or swimming boots, that weighed a lot. So most women chose not to put on that huge amount of clothing and try to learn to swim because it was dangerous. They worried that the skirts would wrap around their ankles and tangle them up, which was not an irrational fear.
So many women and children aboard the General Slocum on that June morning didn't make it to land.
No one knows exactly how many people were aboard. There was no official manifest for the ship, but there were thought to be around 1,350 passengers aboard with 321 survivors. So more than 1,000 people did perish on that day. Until 9/11 happened, it was the deadliest single-day disaster in New York. The public was appropriately horrified. People were really upset, and this reverberated across the country. There were new regulations that came out after that for better safety procedures, better training for crew, having more regular inspections that were actually testing the equipment. And also, municipalities across the country really took note of this and started to offer swim lessons to their residents.
So there was a movement towards teaching more women to swim, but there was still that one big heavy problem.
People knew that there had to be a change in the swimwear if women were going to be able to swim, but this disaster really sort of accelerated that process.
This is where a woman named Annette Kellerman enters the story. Kellerman grew up in Australia in the late 20th century, and as a kid, she was diagnosed with rickets. She used swimming to rehabilitate, and then she became an Australian national swimming champion. Back then, swimming was much more accessible for women living in Australia than in the U.S. In Australia, they weren't expected to wear those constricting bathing outfits.
Men and women wore the same swimsuit style, which was a one-piece that had shorts and a sleeveless top.
As a teenager, Kellerman moved to the U.K., and in 1905, 1 year after the General Slocum disaster, the then 19-year-old attempted something no woman had ever completed, swimming across the English Channel.
And although she didn't make it, she gained a lot of attention for the attempt because she spent a long time in the waters and showed really strong swimming skill. People were fascinated by her. She had a really magnetic personality, and she was invited to perform in front of the royal family. And she knew that in order to give this performance, she wouldn't be able to wear her typical swimming costume.
Like in the US, people in the UK expected women to wear heavy bathing costumes.
And most women at the time, would have thrown a skirt over their swimsuit and called it a day. But Annette didn't want to constrict her movement. So instead, she sewed some black tights into the bottom of the suit. From her chin down to her toes, she was covered in the swimsuit, but it was quite tight, and it allowed her free movement in order to swim while also keeping her covered up. And once people saw this, it became highly fashionable.
I guess it sounds like the royal family was okay with the sort of suit she had created.
They must have approved because, yeah, it really took off after that. People dubbed it the Kellerman, and she traveled all around, came over to the United States, and did swimming demonstrations and shows and wore this famous swimsuit that she invented.
But Shapley says Kellerman's swimsuit wasn't immediately accepted by everyone in the U.S.
Annette Kellerman herself claims that she was arrested on the beach for wearing her signature suit. And there's some debate about whether that actually happened. There don't seem to be records that show it, and it's a story she told a little bit later. But it was certainly true that women were cited and given tickets on beaches for wearing swimsuits that were the one that Annette Kellerman was promoting.
But by the 1920s, Shapley says multiple manufacturers were making suits similar to the Kellerman, and more American women were swimming. In 1926, Gertrude Ederle, who was born in New York City less than a year after the General Slocum disaster, not only became the first woman to successfully swim across the English Channel, she did it faster than any man had done it. Annette Kellerman never completed a swim across the English Channel, but she had plenty of other successes.
She was one of the first sort of fitness celebrities. She went on to continue to swim, to perform in vaudeville showcases, to take her swimming show on the road and to star in movies and to write books. And she would go and give lectures around the country. And in one of her lectures, she said, "You cannot be brave if your diaphragm is squeezed and you can't breathe properly."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really great point that, you know, if you want to be brave, you've got to feel comfortable.
What do you consider her legacy to be? What should we take from her story?
It's amazing how far that we've come for women and athletics, but there are still ideas about what's acceptable for women to do and not to do. And I found that myself. I signed up for a bodybuilding competition. And I found that the reaction was really mixed from the people in my life. There were people who I saw at the gym every day who were very excited to find out how I was training and what my sparkly bikini was going to look like and all of those details. And then there were other people in my life who didn't want me to hurt myself or didn't want me to look like a man or become too big. So even though I've had the opportunity to swim my entire life, there are still activities that some people don't think are appropriate for me.
So Shapley says we can learn from Annette Kellerman to not be constrained by the prevalent standards of our time.
She recognized that women were good at swimming, that they belonged in water, and she made a change that allowed that to happen. And I think there's something that we can learn from that in the modern era as well.
That story was from Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For more on that bodybuilding competition and for more stories of awe-inspiring female athletes of past and present, check out Haley Shapley's recent book, Strong Like Her, a celebration of rule breakers, history makers, and unstoppable athletes. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org. When my mom was a kid growing up in Southern California, her grandparents owned a pool. My mom would spend her entire summer in that pool, except for 1 hour every day after lunch when her grandparents would make her play canasta. Nancy Wiener Marcus is a little older than my mom. She's 75, and she grew up in Dallas, Texas.
It was a known rule. I loved to eat a cheeseburger and a chocolate malt and then fries. And I knew that, God forbid, I would have to get back into the water for, I guess, even to save someone. There'd just be no way because I'd drown for sure.
Here's Katie Martin. She's 22.
I grew up in Toronto, Ontario. I'm Canadian.
Katie wouldn't go swimming after eating either.
Absolutely not, because, well, first of all, I don't know if you've read A Series of Unfortunate Events.
I haven't, but Katie tells me that the books follow three orphans who are sent to live with a series of relatives, and everywhere they go, terrible, or at least unfortunate, things happen.
They go and live with this, their aunt, I think, who lives by a lake, and this lake is infested with flesh-eating leeches.
Ew.
Yes, it's very gross. They can smell food from miles away. And if you go in the water and you smell like food, they will, like, eat the flesh right off your bones.
Back in Dallas, Nancy had a more reasonable-sounding explanation for the rule.
I'll get a cramp because I will not have digested my food, and then I'll drown. And so, I mean, was it 100%? No one took the chance to find out.
Like, after I stopped believing in the flesh-eating leeches, because, you know, at some point, I think I just kept assuming that it was like a dramatization of a real thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you told me that was true right now, I would be willing to believe it.
Now, if I were to assure you that doctors say that there is nothing wrong with going swimming after eating, would that change your mind?
Yes, but knowing me, since I'm kind of known as a Google queen, I would have to Google it to see if it was, in fact, a myth.
I can do better than Google. Let's call up a pediatrician and public health expert.
Please feel free to stay on the line or call back when our call volume may be lighter.
Okay, so while we're waiting for the doctor, I think it's worth asking the question, where did this death by cramp idea come from anyway? A Snopes.com article cites the 1908 British Boy Scout handbook. The warning goes like this.
If you bathe within an hour and a half after taking a meal, that is, before your food is digested, you are very likely to get cramp. Cramp doubles you up in extreme pain so that you cannot move your arms or legs, and down you go. You may drown, and it will be your own fault.
I especially love that last bit. You may drown, and it will be your own fault. But
isn't Snopes.com kind of like a fact-checking
type of
They have their facts wrong. that does not appear in the 1908 British Boy Scout handbook, because I'm holding it and I'm looking at page 88 and it's not on there.
This is Ben Jordan. He's a history professor at Christian Brothers University in Memphis and an expert on the Boy Scouts and other early youth organizations. He says Snopes isn't too far off. A similar but less accusatory warning appears on page 223 in the health section of the 1908 handbook.
And it comes right before the don't smoke and don't drink alcohol warnings.
The warning carried over to the first American Boy Scout handbook in 1911. The man who wrote that chapter wasn't with the Boy Scouts. He was affiliated with YMCA. Like the Boy Scouts and other youth organizations of the time, the YMCA taught boys to hike, camp, and swim the right way, with the right precautions.
Otherwise, it was dangerous or would lead to immorality or excess or a number of other vices.
This idea didn't just apply to hiking and camping and swimming. It also dovetailed nicely into another movement going on at the time.
In the early 20th century, a lot of medical folks and health spas and youth organizations, psychologists and educators were very concerned about digestion.
You really must chew, Mr. Lightbody.
This is from the 1994 movie The Road to Wellville, a dark comedy allegedly set at the Battle Creek Sanatorium run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. Yeah, that Kellogg.
Chew, 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 but only if you chew.
Kellogg and his contemporaries saw digestion as the most important bodily function. The consequences of ignoring the rules of good digestion were considered much more dire than a simple tummy ache.
If your body isn't digesting food right, then your spirit will deteriorate.
So even though there was no evidence that swimming after eating could kill you, the warning stayed in. And that most dire warning, the one with the line that I love,
you may drown, and it will be your own fault.
That appeared in a British Boy Scout manual reprinted in 1954. In the American version of the handbook, the warning became less serious over time, finally disappearing in 1967. But in 1919, 48 years before the American Boy Scouts finally dropped their death by cramp warning, the manual for YMCA camp leaders was already hedging its bets. So if the YMCA boys program had taken off instead of Boy Scouts, we would have been divested of this wives' tale much sooner.
Yes, you could certainly say that. But then they say, but still wait that hour or two. So I guess because it happens occasionally.
But does it? Does it happen even occasionally? Time to see if the pediatrician still has us on hold.
Hi, it's Lester Hartman.
Dr. Lester Hartman has been in practice for 32 years at Westwood Mansfield Pediatrics outside of Boston. And in that time, he's logged a few patient visits.
Probably in my lifetime, somewhere between 40 and 50,000.
So in all that time, has any kid ever shown up to your office with ill effects from having gone swimming after eating?
No. No, not one.
Dr. Hartman says there have been multiple studies, and they've all come to the same conclusion. You are no more likely to drown after eating a big meal than you are on an empty stomach.
Now, you may get nauseated, but so would you if you exercise very heavily.
In fact, Dr. Hartman says the only correlation between consumption and drowning is the consumption of alcohol.
Over 25% of the time, people died after drinking.
The Red Cross first published a study debunking the death by cramp myth in 1968, but the idea persisted. So they put out another major paper in 2011. Still, Dr. Hartman says some parents don't want to believe that the story their mothers told them simply isn't true.
I think they're suspicious. Some people want to cling to myths.
I know what Dr. Hartman's talking about, because when I told 75-year-old Nancy Wiener Marcus that she absolutely would not drown if she went into the pool after eating her lunch, she was polite, but I could tell she didn't believe me.
Trust me, when we hang up, I will go Google it. I can promise you.
Go ahead, Nancy. I already know what you're going to find. That story first aired in July of 2018. In 2018, Captain Jean Gusev was leading an all-women crew in the race to Alaska. They were sleep-deprived and a little bit cranky.
So I go down below and my head hits the pillow and I heard the best word that possibly could have happened in that moment. It was Kelly yelling, orcas.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at OnlyAGameNPR.
Need to escape the news for a moment?
Check out Endless Thread, a podcast from WBUR and Reddit.
From mysteries to histories to stories that will remind you of our shared humanity.
Subscribe to Endless Thread on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game... But now it's time for Charlie Pierce and the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Karen.
The NBA is back with the Lakers and the Clippers providing the highlight of reopening night. The Lakers came out on top 103-101. And even though the matchup did not have screaming fans shouting at each other across the Staples Center floor, Anthony Davis says for him, the game was business as usual.
It felt like a real game to me. You know, two teams battling. Obviously, it's always a good game between us two. Can't complain for the first game.
Do you have any complaints?
No, except that the wall of cyber fans is going to take some getting used to.
But the games are good, right?
At least judging by the Lakers and the Clippers, everybody did a great job of staying in shape. I mean, that was some very high-level NBA basketball.
Before Thursday night's opener between the Pelicans and the Jazz and the aforementioned Lakers-Clippers tilt, all of the players and the coaches and the game officials locked arms and knelt for the national anthem. Afterwards, LeBron James said, quote, "I hope we made Cap proud. I don't know about Colin Kaepernick, but did they make Charlie Pierce proud?
They did. I thought it was a remarkable statement. And not only that, but a further indication that the NBA is far more evolved an institution than, say, Major League Baseball, which is something else we'll get to later.
Well, kneeling during the national anthem is actually officially against NBA rules. Commissioner Adam Silver said that the longstanding rule would not be enforced, quote, under these unique circumstances, which is not exactly saying that it won't be enforced in the future, right?
Well, they can't. I don't think they can enforce it now. They'll look ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think demonstrations for social justice are going to be a part of the NBA right now for a long, long time.
On Wednesday, in just her second game as a pro, Liberty guard Sabrina Ionescu racked up 33 points, 7 rebounds, and 7 assists. But her team ultimately lost the game to the Dallas Wings, leading Ionescu to say, quote, that part still isn't up to my standard. Was her performance up to your standard?
It was extraordinary. I admit, I watched the first game, and I was very impressed by her willingness to fit into what her team was trying to do. And not try to do too much. And now, of course, you know, the talent is now obvious. So we go from here.
Okay, Charlie. We have to talk about the Miami Marlins.
Ah, the Petri dish of Major League Baseball.
Yeah. As of this conversation, and I really hesitate to give a number because it seems to be growing every second, 17 players and 2 coaches have tested positive for COVID-19. All of the team's games have been postponed through Sunday. The Marlins are trying to figure out how to fill roster spots with players who have been training elsewhere, free agents, and waiver wire claims. I mean, this is not good.
No, it's not good, but it's not all that different from the Marlins' demonstrated business plan over the past 4 or 5 years. And obviously, the ripple effects are going throughout baseball. My understanding now is that they're going to load up the players who tested positive on sleeper buses and then transport them back to Miami because they've been locked up in Philadelphia since the outbreak happened.
The Phillies have also had all their games postponed through Sunday. As of this conversation, only 2 of their players have tested positive. Friday night's Brewers-Cardinals game has also been postponed due to a positive test. And this is what happens when you don't have a bubble during a pandemic.
This is what happens when Major League Baseball tries to have it both ways. There simply should not have been a 2020 baseball season. And sooner or later, people are going to come to that conclusion. And, you know, it's going to be worse if they shut it down now. You'll have totally alienated that part of your fan base that's happy to have baseball back.
And finally, Charlie, when the Sports Illustrated brand was purchased by Authentic Brands Group, the Wall Street Journal's Jason Gay joked on this very program that Sports Illustrated brand car washes could not be far behind. Well, it's not a car wash, but what say you of Sports Illustrated TM nutritional supplements?
Oh, excellent, because there's certainly nothing wrong with the nutritional supplements industry. As one who grew up wanting to do what I do because I read the people who wrote for Sports Illustrated when I was a kid, this is beyond sad.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Karen.
A couple years ago, I got a Facebook message from my friend Jean. She was putting together an all-women sailing team. She wanted to know if I would cover the story. I promised I'd track her progress and be in touch if anything interesting happened. I totally dropped the ball. Luckily, I have another friend who's also a journalist who was paying better attention. Reporter Tina Toby Mack has the story.
2 o'clock in the morning on the way north to Alaska is incredibly dark. It's black ink sky. You cannot even see the bow of the boat.
That's Captain Jean Gusev. She and her team of 7 women sailors are competing in the race to Alaska. Their team is called Sail Like a Girl, and they have been at it 24/7 since they left Victoria Harbor 4 days ago. The whole team is exhausted and on edge in the dark. A GPS unit has failed. There are rocks out there, but where? Jean woke up to help figure that out and calm her crew.
Out of the blue, we were in what felt like a massive car crash. You're on a boat in the middle of nowhere, and that is your island. It is your safety. It's your entire world. And in that moment of hitting something as hard as we hit it, I knew that that boat might not be able to carry us anymore.
Jean and her crew were still 190 miles from their destination, Ketchikan, Alaska.
The race to Alaska, a 750-mile race along a coastline that God has forgotten.
The race to Alaska is not for the faint of heart. All boats are welcome. The only rule, the boat must be human or wind-powered. That's it. Everything else, course, vessel, crew, is up for grabs.
The prize for first place is $10,000. The prize for second place is a set of steak knives. There are no other prizes.
It didn't take a fancy promotional video to convince Jean that the race to Alaska was for her. She's an experienced sailor and captain. She wanted the challenge. She also wanted to test the idea that the most competent sailors are men. The plan came together, as many good things do.
It happened over whiskey. It was at the end of a race and at the yacht club party, as is pretty typical. The guys are all puffing up their chests and talking about their warrior moments on sailboats. And it's hard to even be part of those conversations. And I was particularly frustrated that weekend at just the masculinity in our sport. So Anna asked me, would you ever do Race to Alaska with an all-women's crew? And I immediately said yes.
Anna is Sail Like a Girl teammate Anna Stevens.
Within a week, I was looking at boats online and trying to concoct a plan for what to do and how to build a Race to Alaska team.
Jean found a used 32-foot boat in Dana Point, California. They christened her Max to the Moon.
I knew that was the boat that we needed. It is a Ferrari on the water. It's super fast, and it has a big open transom, so I knew we could put bikes on it.
The bikes are for when there is no wind. Remember, the race is 750 miles. Wind and human power alone.
We call it our boatsicle. Our bikes off the back of our boat with propellers attached.
The newly formed Sail Like a Girl team spent weekends taking the boat apart, upgrading and repairing all the equipment on board. Their boat is a day sailor, meant for short, single-day races. No head, no galley. They had to come up with a plan for the cooking, sleeping, and the potty. The ladies bonded during these long boat-building sessions. When they were ready to hit the water, they sailed together twice a week for training. After about 3 months, they were ready. The boat was packed to the brim with gear, food, water, the number one and two bucket, and a ton of sails. It was time for the race. But the first step wasn't the easiest. Captain Jean.
The fear of the unknown is unrivaled by most things. The first and the most difficult step is the one where your foot leaves the dock. The anticipation of that one moment is huge. You don't know what happens next.
But the start was quiet. The women were on course and biking their way to Ketchikan. Cell service was spotty. They were surrounded by the beauty of the coast and unconcerned with the outside world. All that mattered was the boat, the ocean, their teammates, and the race. Then they got to Bella Bella, a waypoint in the 2018 competition. There, they got an update. They were in the lead. Also, they got cell service.
We got in touch with our community for really the first time, and we realized that we were being supported by women everywhere and that we had people rooting us on and that really wanted us to do well. And we no longer were doing this just for us. We were doing this for other people. And the stress landed on our heads like a ton of bricks. For the first and only time on board the boat, our team dynamic broke.
Sailing away from Bella Bella, tempers were short. The women retreated to the corners of the boat. Conversations were snippy. Everyone was complaining about their job on the boat and unsure what to do. To sail properly, the women had to come back together. They had to work as a team.
We had Kelly on board. Kelly's a yoga instructor. And she said, okay, everybody close your eyes except for Haley, who's driving. And she led us through breathing exercises. And so the entire dynamic of the boat is now back to this positive, happy place.
With the team dynamic reestablished, Jean headed to bed.
So I go down below and I get into my sleeping bag and my head hits the pillow and I heard the best word that possibly could have happened in that moment. It was Kelly yelling, "Orcas." There's nothing like being surrounded by a pod of orcas to change the mood of any situation. It's just magic. It's pure magic.
Led by the orcas and back in sync with each other and the wind, Team Sail Like a Girl was still in the lead. There were a lot of challenges ahead, and the women were ready to face them. Then, sailing through that inky dark Alaska night at 2 a.m, that pesky GPS unit failed. Jean woke up and came out on deck.
We are in hundreds of feet of water, and out of the blue, we are in a 2 a.m, all lights out, car crash. We were going probably 7 to 8 knots of boat speed, and we came to a dead stop.
7 to 8 knots is roughly 10 miles per hour.
And all I could think, because I'm holding my GPS, and I screamed it. I was like, there are no rocks here. How did we run aground? How did we run aground? There are no rocks here. There's over 100 feet of water. And Haley said, Jean, look off the back. And I came to the transom of the boat and looked down, and there was a log hanging off the back of the boat, and it was lodged on our keel.
Jean guessed the log was 20 feet long, and they were sitting on it in the middle of the open water.
So we got everybody down on the low side and heeled the boat over, and the log popped up and floated away. But we didn't know if we were damaged. We knew that there was not really any help anywhere close. And it's part of the race. You have to be able to help yourself. You have to save yourself out there.
They sat, sails down, until the sun came up. The boat was immobilized for hours. Any chance of winning seemed gone. In the morning, the team raced on, monitoring their injured boat. They were still pushing as hard as they could to get to the finish line, which, after another 2 days of sailing, was in sight. About 20 miles from the finish, they got cell service and discovered they were in the lead. The team planned to be on the dock ringing the finish line bell by dinner time. Then the wind died and night set in. The harbor was a confusing mashup of fishing boats, buoy lights, and barges. They were having trouble finding the finishing dock. Finally, they spotted a light swinging in the darkness and knew that must be it. With a time of 6 days, 13 hours, and 17 minutes, Team Sail Like a Girl won the 2018 Race to Alaska.
That's reporter Tina Toby Mack. The 2020 Race to Alaska was canceled due to the pandemic, but Team Sail Like a Girl plans to be back again in 2021. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. And one quick update before I let you go. On Wednesday, August 12th, I'll be hosting a live virtual event diving deeper into our recent special episode, Sports, Racism, and the Myth of Meritocracy. Find more info and register for free at wbur.org/events. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.